This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. Obviously, we're living in different times at the moment. So what we're doing in by way of podcast is bringing you the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, purely and simply because there is so much information that we're getting in from listeners around the world, it seems a pity to waste it. So this is what we've been up to this week.
You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland.
Flaming June? I don't think so. Ha! There was torrential rain last night, and it's got slightly humid this morning, and it's misty and claggy and a very, very soft day altogether. I'm Mark Stephen. With me about 45 miles to the north, Mr. Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, good morning from Bamshire. As you say, it's a bit claggy, but it's slightly atmospheric. You know, there's not a breath of wind. The Har's just hanging in there, and it's strangely romantic, for want of a better expression. It's a bit early for that.
Coming up shortly on Out of Doors, Gerda Stevenson takes us in a walk around Newhall Woods. I recount my worst experience of midges ever. And I bet you can't. I really bet you can't. Can you tell me what this sound is? Now, one thing I've really noticed in the verges, particularly at the moment, is the amount of wildflowers that have come out. Round about us, there's things like cow parsley, Swiss Sicily, you know, the umbellifers you've got, things like red campion, the obvious ones like dandelions, gorse. There is a lot of colour. There's actually quite a lot of scent out there at the moment, too.
I've been glorying in the fact the council haven't been cutting the verges and they say the red campion out, the seed bed's getting better. And then suddenly, people all around me have started taking the law into their own hands. And there are ride-on tractors going around the verges of Bamshire, cutting them for the council. As you know, I'm really into the folklore, the birds and animals. I'm not so hugely knowledgeable about plants. So I was blown away when we spoke to Gregory Kenniter of the Royal Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh the other week.
Yeah, Greg's an interesting fellow. He's just published a book on the plant lore of Scotland, featuring illustrations, history, practical uses for a whole range of plants. Now, it was fascinating to learn, for example, that the now much maligned bracken was once highly valued.
I love it, he says, with a kind of qualified air for things.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I know it is demonised. A lot of folks think of it as a villainous plant, but it's a native plant, and it's a core part of our flora, if you like. And nowadays, I guess, we see it as it's got these issues with it being toxic to livestock, which, of course, is a serious issue. And there are some hints that potentially the spores could be carcinogenic for a short window each year. So, you know, be a bit careful when you're out and about in bracken when it's sporulating. But in the past, it was the basis for a whole host of different industries. So people used to burn bracken for ash, and that was used for fertilizer. It was used for making glass. The fronds themselves were used for packing glass as well. So as a kind of packing material for delicate things, you had the stalks themselves of the individual fronds being used for thatching, so it was quite a useful thatch, not a long-lasting one, but a useful and versatile thatch. And these are all things that we've forgotten and lost, and I can't help thinking it's quite a good representative of something which could do with a bit better PR at the moment, if you know what I mean, because lots of these plants, they've got lots of potential, I think.
It's interesting that you take that perspective, because when I speak to farmers, you know, and hill farmers particularly, because bracken grows in really inaccessible places sometimes, and what you see as a valuable resource, they see as a real, not just a pest. It costs them big money, because very often the only way that you can spray bracken, you can kill it, is by helicopter, and that's not cheap.
Yeah, and that's a position I can completely sympathise with. It is one of these things where you've got that real problem with it. I guess it's a case of if we can look at how we can explore how we might be able to use these and exploit these, so that might be a way to keep that population down, but put it to a good use, would be another thing. And that's not to kind of gainsay anything that farmers would suggest there, but it's just, I wonder if there are some other interesting approaches we could take, some of them from the past, that might actually give us some potential for the future and also help to suppress that population. And I bet you, because it was being so heavily used in the past, it wasn't anywhere near as invasive as we see it today, because it was being harvested so much and used so much.
Aye, quite possibly. The next plant you've chosen on your list is actually one of my favourites. It's not one of the showiest in the countryside, but, you know, what I love about it is, well, two things, smell and the taste. Sweet Sicily.
Yeah, it's a wonderful thing. So it's one of these ones that we say was kind of introduced by the monks or the Romans, he says, doing air quotation marks, as in, we don't know quite where it came from, but it's a European mainland plant. And we're fairly sure it's not what we'd say is native. So it was brought in by humans. And it was brought in because it is such a beautiful and versatile wee plant. So it's a great, great thing for flavouring up food. So it's got this lovely kind of subtle anise flavour. So even if you don't like aniseed, strong aniseed taste, it's got this beautiful sweet version of that. It's quite nice and subtle. But I think one of its big main reasons it was brought in is as a strewing herb. So people would harvest the leaves, and if you were in your castle or your manor house or wherever it was, you'd probably have the livestock in there with you, and you'd have all kinds of sweaty, unwashed bodies. So you would throw down Sweet Sicily as a strewing herb on the floor, like a kind of temporary carpet. And as people walked over it, it would waft up this lovely scent, and it would kind of help to banish all these slightly medieval stenches that were around. And when you were done with it, once it had been worn down, you could just sweep the entire carpet out the door. Brilliant, really convenient, you know.
I can hear parents of adolescent children all over the world saying, I need that for their garden.
It does really, really well through kind of central and eastern Scotland. It's more of a mainland European thing, but it's found its own wee niche here. And just in shady woodlands, you'll find it popping up. It's a member of the carrot family, some species of which are pretty poisonous indeed. Some of our most poisonous plants are in the same family. So it could be confused with it, but Sweet Sicily's got these really distinctive little silver patches on these very soft, furry leaves, and that helps you to distinguish it from other things. But I would say, if you're ever thinking to go out and harvest things or use them yourself, A, be absolutely certain what you were ever thinking of harvesting and using and how you're going to use it, and B, the sustainable harvesting is one of the big issues, so be super careful about not taking too much.
Well, you're talking about harvesting, because this next one has been harvested extensively. I'm a big fan of bogs. I'm one of those people who will actually go and lie in the bog and feel the movement, hear the insects. You really get in touch with nature. But sphagnum is a key in the bog, but such a fascinating plant.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So it's a moss, so it doesn't have any flowers at all. It's got these beautifully adapted cells that will help to take in water. And if you take a bit of sphagnum and squeeze it, you can see how much water is in there, that absorbent quality. And that's what basically makes these sphagnum blanket bogs work as bogs. They can hold that amount of water, and underneath, as everything dies off, the kind of lower layers will eventually shift over and become peat. So they're responsible for, you know, something that was a very big industry in Scotland in the past. Key thing of these habitats, but also, of course, they're really famous because even right up to the World Wars, certainly World War I, people collected huge amounts of sphagnum, and there was this big effort to collect sphagnum, take it back down to processing centres, sterilise it, sew it up into packages. To be honest, a little bit like my mum, for example, has been sewing lots of masks for NHS workers, and it's the same kind of idea as what we're seeing today, but people sewing these parcels that would then go off to the front and be really critical dressings for saving lives on the front, you know?
Dr. Gregory Kenniser there, and you can hear more from him in the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which you'll find in the podcast section of the Outdoors page on the BBC Radio Scotland website, or you can find it on BBC Sounds, and lots of people seem to be, which is quite actually reassuring. It's a fascinating listen, Ewan.
Hey, you know what? I've been having an absolute ball doing these midweek podcasts, because we've said it before, I'll say it again, we're speaking to the guys at the top of their game.
Yeah.
You know, these are the real experts, whether it's a sound recordist or a filmmaker or a folklorist. We're getting access to people that just are fascinating to listen to. And because there's no time limit on the podcast, it gives it time to breathe. And you get just so much out of these people.
Yeah, I was listening back to it the other day, the Gregory Cancer one, and thinking, you see, said, it hasn't got flowers, therefore it's a moss. And I'm going, I should have asked him, what makes a moss? So many questions. We've had one mystery sound so far in the programme, courtesy of Ewan. That one was definitely not a bird, but this one is.
So, any guesses on that one? The one that's sounding really alarmed is a blackbird, so it's not the blackbird we're looking for, it's the other one. If you can recognise that chatter, have a go. There's no prizes, just the glory. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
A few weeks back, actress and writer Gerda Stevenson took us on a walk near her home in Carlops on the edge of the Pentland Hills. We're back with Gerda again on another walk in her area, this time combining her culinary and literary interests.
I'm heading into the woods at Newhall in the Pentland Hills, not far from where I live, to get some wild garlic. At this time of year, the young garlic, wild garlic leaves coming up are absolutely delicious, really strong tasting. And I put them into a white sauce with some fish, and it's absolutely delicious. I like coming into the woods and foraging. Where I'm walking now, around about July, I would normally find chanterelles under a whole line of beech trees. And that's something I love to do, pick chanterelles in July, August, and cook them up with some butter, fry them in butter and serve them on toast, and they're so delicious. They have that kind of mossy woodland taste. I wrote a poem about my daughter picking chanterelles here. Picking chanterelles. Eyes bright with the search, you clutch your small basket under gusting silver birch, summer's last flush on your cheeks, and suddenly our luck's in. A blaze of tiny can-can skirts kick their hems at our feet. Your pink fingernails plunge their pocket money glamour into wet moss, your laughter gold as the fluted flesh you pluck from the earth. So I'm going on into the woods now. This place is steeped in literary history. This is the world of Alan Ramsay, the poet who inspired Ferguson, who then in his turn inspired Burns. So there's a kind of legacy there in the Scots language, because Alan Ramsay had a particular desire to revive the Scots language. And he wrote so beautifully in it, particularly in a lovely kind of opera that he wrote called The Gentle Shepherd, which is based in these woods in Newhall. And there are many sights here that appear in the drama of The Gentle Shepherd, places that I go to regularly. I'm walking now close to Peggy's pool. You can hear the waterfall. It's a lovely pool. You can swim in it in the summer when the water's a wee bit warmer. There's a lovely big flat rock above the waterfall that we like to sit on and have a picnic, me and the kids when they were little. They're grown up now, but we still go there. And the stone gets quite hot in the sunlight. It's lovely just to sit there and feel the warmth of the stone. Peggy is a character in Alan Ramsay's Gentle Shepherd. And she was brought up by a character called Moz, who was thought to be a witch. There are lots of stories of witches in Carlops. And in fact, next to my house there's a big witch's rock. It's called Carlan's Loup, witch's leap in folk etymology. So yes, we have lots of witches' stories around here, and they crept into Alan Ramsay's Gentle Shepherd. There are lots of up and down walks in these woods. And I'm heading towards a wonderful cave known as Sandy's Cave. Another of Alan Ramsay's haunts. It's wonderful. It really looks mysterious. There's kind of two archways at the entrance, what we call the entrance. And then there's another kind of wee hole in the side, which is like a window. And we used to think it was a bit like the rabbit's hole in Winnie the Pooh, where Winnie the Pooh gets stuck. We used to do Easter egg hunts around here. And the final golden Easter egg was always hidden somewhere in the cave. So here's the wild garlic. There's just masses of it. So I'm picking just a few wee leaves. In a couple of weeks, this will all be flowering, and the whole woodland floor will be covered in thousands and thousands of white wild garlic stars, because that's what the blossoms look like. They're absolutely beautiful. There we are. This will be enough for my white sauce with my fish. I'm coming down the hill and nearing the burn again. Another wee bridge. A wee wooden bridge across it. And before I cross the bridge, there's a lovely little carving in a piece of rock. And it's a tribute to Alan Ramsay from The Gentle Shepherd. Beneath the south side of a craggy beeld, where crystal springs the halsome waters yield, twa youthful shepherds on the gowans lay, tenting their flocks a bonny morn of May. Lovely. Lovely to see that. Some poetry written into the stone in the woods. There's the dog waiting by the river. She wants me to throw a stick into it. Okay, come on. Where's your stick? She puts it places and I'm supposed to find it. There we go. She likes me to go up onto the bridge and then throw it from the bridge into the water, and then she splashes into the river. There you go. Simple pleasures.
Gerda Stevenson there at Newhall Woods. You know, I haven't made it in years, but I really like wild garlic soup. It's a beautiful, really sort of delicate taste, I reckon, Ewan.
It's one of those things I just love, and I've tried to plant wild garlic in the woods around me with spectacular lack of success. It's just such a lovely aroma in the kind of late spring. It's just wonderful. It'll go well with your bacon this morning.
That's very true. That's very true. Can we hear, you know, we started off this programme with a really, really strange, even by our standards, really strange mystery sound. Not the bird sound, this is another sound. Can we hear it again? Right, now, I started off by saying I was absolutely convinced that nobody would guess what that is, but one person's got remarkably close.
Really?
And I'm not going to, and I'm not going to say which one it actually is. With several responses so far, John and Elgin says, is it a water-driven mill starting up? That's actually a very clever idea. Mm-hmm. Peter Fraser says, it's either you or me caught short because all the public toilets are shut in Aberdeenshire. Ian Infantry says, is it the sound of smashed chunks of ice on the shoreline? Again, a very, very good suggestion.
You can see where he's coming from there.
Yeah, too straight.
That tinkling sound. Yeah, no, it's pretty close. It's not that, but it's close.
Yeah, very, very close. Coming up, we'll be looking at the fact the Highland Show lives on. We'll hear how, and everyone's favourite, the midgie. Mr. McElroy, yet again, this is a weekly occurrence, has been musing. They can't touch you for it. And you'll never guess about what.
Yeah, too much time on my hands, I think. My mind does work in a kind of mysterious way every now and again, and I've been thinking about it.
Good.
Barbed wire. It's everywhere. But, you know, who invented it? What's its history? Now, come on, this is interesting, I promise.
Yes, yes.
And
it's
the sound
you hear
at the top of the programme is the sound of barbed wire, and I'll tell you about how that came about in a moment or two. You'd be amazed.
Just before you leap out of bed, aiming for the off switch. Remember when I did a thing on bricks years ago? Everybody took the mickey out of me in here. It was one of the most fascinating things, Scottish bricks, that we've ever actually done. So, barbed wire, stick with us. This is Ewan's plea.
Because it is absolutely fascinating. And you do want to hear what that sound is, don't you? On the 24th of November, 1874, the United States Patent Office issued patent number 157124 to Joseph F. Gilden of Illinois, a patent that would change the world of agriculture forever, with the invention of what became to be known by Native Americans as devil's rope. He didn't actually invent it. He just took a previous patent by Michael Kelly in 1868 and made it better. Gilden invented a new and valuable improvement in wire fences, with the goal to preserve cattle from breaking through wire fences. The fence wire is composed of two strands, which are designed to be twisted together after the spur. Barbed wire had arrived, and farming would never be the same again. It revolutionised the American cattle business initially and sounded the death knell for the open range around the world. Before barbed wire, if ranchers wanted a fence for the livestock, they made it out of wood, which was expensive because it was scarce in the West and had to be shipped in from the East. Before barbed wire, fences consisted of a single strand of wire that could be easily broken by cattle. Without fencing to keep the cattle in, the bovines grazed freely, competing for grass and water and destroying crops like wheat. And every year, cattle owners led their herds to slaughterhouses, unhindered by wire fencing. Barbed wire limited the open range, and in turn limited the freedom of ranchers and cowboys. Barbed wire had a major impact on the many settlers and nomadic Native Americans living in the West. Previously, the land had been open for public use, with many ranchers' cattle roaming freely, eating and drinking. Now the ranchers and the settlers fenced off their land, which started many disputes and eventually led to a concentration of serious power in the hands of the landowners, the big landowners. The wealthy ranchers started fencing off their land, and individuals with livestock but no land had nowhere for their cattle to graze. Because much of the public land that was left had become overgrazed, and for the small-time ranchers, many had to sell out to the big boys and then become workers on the big farms. Nomadic Native Americans used to roam freely, but now these barbed wire fences began to limit their movements, and some began calling the barbed wire the devil's rope. The invention of barbed wire changed the West permanently by limiting the open range and starting many, many, many fights over land. Now, as I said before, Gildan didn't invent barbed wire. He simply made it better. And what he did is he locked the barbs into place with a double strand of wire and invented a machine that mass-produced it. His patent was challenged in 1892, but in 1895 he won his case and is now considered the father of barbed wire. It caught on quickly around the world, and even looking around me here today in Banffshire, every field, as far as the eye can see, is topped with devil's rope. And finally, not every country is a fan of barbed wire. Because of the risk of injuries to migrating animals, in 2010, Norway prohibited the making of new fences with barbed wire. And finally, there's a really positive spin-off for Norway, because Rolls-Royce motor cars use Norwegian hides for their luxury leather interior in their cars, because the hides from Norwegian cattle have fewer scratches and cuts than hides from countries where barbed wire is used. The devil's rope, a wire that changed the world.
This was our first mystery sound this morning. Before you actually explain what it is, here's another excellent guess. This is from Ross in Lancashire, who says, is it bat droppings landing on the floor of a cave?
Well, you can see where he's coming from there, can't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a great sound.
I love this sound. I could listen to this all day.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like rain on a corrugated iron roof to me.
Yeah, you're close. What it is it's a contact microphone, the kind of thing that you would put on a Spanish guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an amazing storm last Friday, you know, big huge hailstones, really high wind. So I clamped this mic on a barbed wire fence at the back of the garden, and the sound you're hearing are hailstones hitting the wire.
Wow.
It's a really kind of unsettling sound.
Yeah. We spend our lives concentrating on sounds to a certain extent. And years ago, somebody told me about it was a scientific project where they basically put a recorder in the centre and then ran piano wire out. I mean, huge distances, 2-3 kilometres, something like that, in a sort of radial pattern. And then it was the sound of, it was either hailstones or rain or wind, actually playing it like an Aeolian harp. I've heard about it, but I've never been able to find it.
We should try and replicate it. Really, the other slightly disturbing thing I found about barbed wire was, certainly in the First World War, they really prized it as a low-tech weapon of war, because mm-hmm. they laid it out in funnels, and when the attacking soldiers came across no man's land, mm. they got funneled into a very small space. It didn't have a happy ending.
No. This is kind of, it's related sort of in a way, in that it's about entrapment. This email's come in from Ian McDade, Carron Valley in Fintry. While out walking my dog locally at Carron Valley Reservoir near Fintry, we came across a pink length of thread high in the branches of a bush. Normally I wouldn't pay much attention, but this seemed unusual. And my eye followed it across to another bush, then down over a small dike, then 30 feet further over the grass, and it disappeared over the edge of a grass verge. And he'd noticed his dog's behaving strangely. I looked again at the thread and saw a large brown wing flash into view, and immediately became clear what this was. A large tawny owl was struggling, entangled in what turned out to be fishing line. After some very, very careful, I'm sure, untangling in what turned out to be no scissors to hand, I had to bite the line to free it from a tight knot within its wing feathers. I did experience several rather nippy punctures to my hand during the struggle to release it, but this was probably a parenting owl. He goes on to say, wonderful radio, world-class stuff, and your descriptions bring it to life on my wee black box. Keep it going, the whole team, from Ian McDade there. Well, thank you very much for that. Very kind. That's an extraordinary experience.
Yeah, and just don't discard fishing line.
Too straight. Coming up, we look forward to the online Highland show. Coelacoides impunctatus, the midgie. We're not looking forward to that particularly. Where is the worst place in Scotland for midges? Seriously, where's the worst place? And what is making this racket?
So if you know what that is, get in touch, and let's face it, most of you know already. Apart from Ruth in Glasgow, she thought it was a missile thrush, so it's not a missile thrush. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
This is the problem of having two mystery sounds first thing in the programme, because I'm not sure which is the answer to. Keith in Hertfordshire reckons it's a bullfrog, but I don't know whether it's the mystery bird or the barbed wire with the hailstones. I don't know. Could be either one. You never know. Our archive piece this week was inspired by a birthday request to take the floor, your request programme last Sunday. Family members wanted to say a very happy birthday to Wilmer Ross and Kinloch Burvey. They also wanted to remind presenter Gary Innes that Wilmer and her husband Lackey had appeared on this programme, Out of Doors, and that we'd commented at the time that they were pure radio gold. So, let's face it, there's nothing for it but to hear it again. Karen McKenzie, who occasionally escapes, went mussel collecting with Wilma and Lackey.
Hello, are you Wilma?
Yes.
I work for Radio Scotland.
Yes, come on in.
So I'm doing a little piece on picking mussels, and I'm looking for somebody or whose relatives might have picked mussels years ago, and everyone has pointed me in your direction.
Come on in, Lachlan might be able to help you. Excuse the Buddha, because I'm getting my bins stuff ready. Lachlan! There's a lovely lady here. Can we go through the front?
Did your mother, Katie, was it?
Yeah, Katie? My mother was Katie.
And she used to pick mussels?
Oh, she loved mussels. If we went up to Durness, she was always picking Durness, mussels up in Durness. Not down here? In the bay. I think when they were in Enchegra, they picked mussels down on the bay there, yes.
Right. So, the tide is out at 4:30 today. I don't suppose you've got half an hour then, have you, to come mussel picking with me?
I'll come with you, but I know... Lachlan, come and help me out here. See this woman here? Yeah. She's got me trapped. She was pointed here because of picking mussels.
They would have been... You know, 6 hours too early for mussels because the tide's in the
house. Yeah, 4:30. I looked it up. Do you like mussels?
Not particularly. I don't mind them.
I love mussels.
Do you?
Really love mussels.
And how did you eat them? How did you cook them?
We didn't do them fancy with the white wines and all that stuff. And the chopped onions and stuff. They're lovely just by themselves, to be honest.
So what do you think? Are you up for coming with me?
I'll come with you, no bother.
Would you? So we pick you up about 4:45 then?
I'll be fine now.
Yes, no bother. They're just poke your way in here because they're all at the base of the rock.
So how do you know where to find them?
If you find a rock and then lift
the seaweed.
The seaweed, and they're all collected at the bottom. Now we'll have to find another rock that's sitting up.
No, not that one.
That one there, maybe.
So, is this where your mum came to pick mussels?
She would have been here because she was actually living on the Westminster Estate, which were... This is all here, belongs to the Westminsters. Uh-huh. And I actually was born in that the cottage up at Budna Bay there, because my father was a gamekeeper.
And you know this area very well,
yes,
indeed.
But... she would come here when we were kids. But then when she was a kid, it would be down at Enchegra Bay there.
Yes. Yeah.
But latterly, when she got older, she used to get the nice mussels up at Sashgrim on the way to Durness.
How many folk do you think actually come and pick mussels nowadays?
Look, we have some here.
Oh, yes.
Look at that.
Let's pull them off. Oh,
that's it. There's a lot of people I've seen in... Look at this lot.
Oh, yes.
Come gathering wilks. But see, they're too lazy now because they're cultivating them in the bay. And they'll just get them and buy them when somebody else has picked them.
Yeah.
How different do they taste from the farmed ones? Aye.
Well, myself personally, I wouldn't pass the natural mussel, yes.
A lot tastier.
Yeah, a lot tastier, and the colour is so much better. Nice, rich, pinky red, and the mussels grown on the ropes are just pale, very pale, anything as I've seen.
Dernis with a limestone in the water in the Kyla Dernis.
So what does limestone do?
Just more nutrients in the soil there, right. Well, in the water. Uh-huh. With it being limestone all the way around the Kyle, it just leaches off the limestone there.
And Lachlan, as somebody who's been in the fishing industry, what, how many years?
60 years in the...
60
in the
years. Mussels a big part of your diet?
Not,
be honest.
Not frequently. I'm more into fish. No, I'm not a shellfish person.
You wouldn't thank us for a mussel?
No, I'd sooner have a haddie any day.
And what are the rules in terms of mussels? You know, when are you supposed to pick them?
Any time of the year, they're good if there's an hour in the month. September right down to April. In the summertime, you get a lot of growth in the water.
Right.
And you get algae in there. There's a lot of toxins in the water for the time of year.
Wouldn't do us any good.
No, you can get sick with them. Aye.
Well, you two with all the talking you're doing, you're never going to get your starter for tonight, are you?
Well, okay then. Let's get down to it.
There's no starter unless you bend your back. Look at this. Half a pail already.
I know. And I've got hee-haw. So, yeah. Wilma, how will you be cooking them tonight?
I take the scrubbing brush at the back door and take all the barnacles off them.
Oh, will you take the barnacles off them? God, that'll take a long time.
Give it not just a wee scrub on that hairy bits
that
there.
That beard.
The beard. And get them just really the mud and stuff off them.
Uh-huh.
And then a pan of boiling water, a big pan, and shove them in. Take them through the boil and the shells will all open and then they're ready for pulling it out.
So they'll be on your plate by what time?
Oh, an hour after I go home. The mussels and the wash them down with the wine.
Well, bon appetit.
Cara McKenzie there, along with Wilma and Lackey Ross, and a happy belated birthday to Wilma from all of us here on Out of Doors. She just bullied them into going out onto the shoreline and picking mussels there.
She's got a whole new approach to interviewing. You know, you and I can have a wee chat, and she just bashes people over the head with the microphone and that boundless enthusiasm. Yeah. But you can't listen to that and not have a smile on your face. Fantastic.
Yeah, you're sitting there doing nothing. Come out with me and pick mussels. That's it. There's a huge, huge response to the mystery bird this week. I mean, like, seriously, I mean, it's always popular, but this has just gone daft this week. Basically, we're sweating bolts in there. Dugald and Kilboki got it right. Ian, however, got it wrong. He thought it was a starling. Kath in the Falkland Islands got it right.
Wow.
There's still some suggestions coming in for that other mystery sound we were playing. This is a really nice one from Ian. He says, is it the sound of the sea lapping in Fingal's Cave in summertime? There's some really imaginative suggestions coming in for that. We should do that more often. Just noises that make no sense at all, and see what people say.
Because you ruined people's visits to the Fingal's Cave, didn't you? Because you started singing.
Only for a brief period of time, then I had to run. Unfortunately, this year has seen the cancellation of the Royal Highland Show, along with just about every other agricultural show that's usually held in Scotland every summer. But all is not lost. Newspaper publishers DC Thompson have paired up with the Royal Highland Show to host an online show complete with, wait for it, livestock competitions, a virtual beer tent and virtual trade stands on the 3rd and the 4th of July. Now, to tell us all about it, we're joined by Struan Nimmo from DC Thompson. Good morning, Struan. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, no problem at all. Our pleasure. Thanks for taking the time to do it. Where did this idea come from?
Well, it all started with this unprecedented COVID-19 crisis, and the impact it's had on our families, individuals and businesses has been profound. And at DC Thompson Media, we want to help people in our community. And next, we wondered about how best to support a farming community, which is a real core audience to the Courier and Press in general. And the agricultural show season is so important to that community. And many farmers, they're basically missing out on their holidays this year. So the question was, how could we help? Could we do a virtual agricultural show? And I looked at how we would be able to do that. How would you host videos, for example? Because, you know, I'm a farmer to trade, and it's important, you know, to judge animals. You need to see the whole animal. You need that 365 angle, and you need to see the bull walk. You need to see the whole of the sheep to get the confirmation. So once we were happy with the technology, we wanted to engage with as many people as possible, and they approached the Royal Highland Show, who got behind us immediately and helped with the categories and judging, and you know, kept us on the straight and narrow. And there's a real partnership approach here, because it's also benefiting something very close to the Highland Show's hearts and our hearts, which is the Royal Highland Education Trust, because all entry fees go to them. And hopefully it's going to be a good thing.
So how's it going to work? Are people going to send videos of their animals and then you get judged on that?
Yeah, so, I mean, we have the traditional classes you'd expect at shows. So you've got sections for sheep, cattle, horses, poultry, goats and young handlers. So for those ones, we're expecting videos. And what we've got is it's a simple YouTube link. So you upload your video to YouTube and put the entry into our form. If people are having difficulties with technology, that's no problem. We'll do it for them. It's really no problem. But there's lots of other things in there. So it's not just the animals. But you know, I think you mentioned the beer there. So we've got a beer tent. We've got food. So you can see a shop window for all our, you know, top class agricultural produce that we have in this fantastic country. And we've got a dog class. We've got baking. You know, and how do you judge if a cake's got a soggy bottom or not? I'm not entirely sure. And one for
you, give the scone to Mark.
I volunteered myself to eat as many cakes as possible. But one for you, Ewan. Of course, we've got the vintage tractor section. I wondered about your wee grey Fergie.
Oh, I could enter that. So this is serious, isn't it? A bit of fun then.
There's a bit of fun in it, but there's also the serious element. This is an opportunity for farmers to showcase their animals. The Highland Show wouldn't have got on board with us if we didn't have a proper animal section. So, yeah, we've got the serious element. We're expecting some really good competition in there, in those animal sections. But, yeah, there's a wee bit of fun. I mean, that's what the shows are about. There's the serious elements, but there's also the fun elements.
Who's going to actually judge this? Because in any, you know, like the Royal Highland Show, for example, say there's 20 beasts entered in a particular class, etc., you know, 19 owners will be convinced the judge is an absolute idiot, you know, and the 20th one thinks, well, obviously, you know, there's, you know, of average ability and just spotted what was, you know, a glaring apparent truth. Are you going to try genuinely judging off these videos?
Absolutely, the judging is really important. But you know, and I can assure somebody, it's not when a journalist after doing a 10-hour shift in the P&J that's doing it. These are the proper Highland Show judges. Where possible, we've tried to get the judges that were available this year for the show anyway. So we've been working closely with Highland Show to get the right people. So you know, these are the, you know, big names, if you like, in the farming industry.
You're a farmer yourself, so you'll know as well as anybody, Highland Show is not just about cattle and hens. There's a huge social aspect to it. So you touched on it, you're going to have a beer tent. Are you expecting farmers to go and sit at the bottom of the garden in the caravan with a dram?
Well, I mean, it's the great thing about a virtual show is that you know, there's no harm in having been able to get out there and you don't have to necessarily get wet to have that show experience. Yeah, we've got this beer tent, so it's not actually something you can go in there and there's like a chat room or anything. It's something we can go in and showcase all the fine produce that we have. It'll be a really good opportunity for farmers to go on there. It's on the 3rd to 4th of July. All the details are there on www.scottishagriculturalshow.co.uk. It's not going to be perfect. You know, we don't have every single class that the Highland does. It's going to be great fun, and I'm hoping everybody gets behind it.
I'm sure everybody will get behind it. I'm sure entries will be excellent for it. And as you say, Struan, I mean, basically any money's raised from this is going to go to the Royal Highland Educational Trust, which is an excellent cause. Thanks very much for joining us this morning. There is a link on our website to the online Scottish Agricultural Show site where you can find out how to enter and find out all the other information about it.
Next Saturday, we're going to be dedicating much of our programme to our past visits to the Highland Show. And if you've got any memories, or if you're interested in getting livestock ready for the Highland Show, just get in touch. Send us an email, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
The other week, I noticed a tweet from writer and broadcaster Alison Craig. During lockdown, she's been enjoying the bird life in her garden, except for one particular visitor, the crow. She doesn't like crows. We asked Alison if she might like to record a wee piece for us on her new pastime.
Having spent, well, no time in my garden, to be honest, until this year, I used it as a piece of ground to walk across to get to my car. The past few months have been an absolute revelation. I've gone from woman who doesn't give a monkeys about the garden or the wildlife in it to being quite obsessed. I love sitting out in the garden watching the birds. It's actually a bit like a Spike Milligan film around our place in the morning. As early as six, if the weather's good, I can be sitting out there in my dressing gown in a chair with binoculars. I know, I sound like I'm barking, but it's so worth it. Beautiful birds in our garden we've got, and they're just British normal birds. They're not exotica. We've got robins. We've got blackbirds, two male blackbirds and a female blackbird. And I think three of them are living together. It's all very modern, but it's working for them. Who am I to criticise? We've got sparrows, we've got chaffinches, blue-tit, coal-tit, and goldfinches. Oh my goodness, the first time I saw them, I literally squeaked because I thought, nobody's ever seen one of these before. But I've got this amazing app where you take a picture of the bird or record its bird song and the app recognises it for you. And right enough, it's goldfinches. We've got about three or four in the garden. So what a joy to be able to sit here on days when you can't go very far and you're going a little bit stir crazy and just watch nature at its best. And then, looming in the background, come, dun dun dun, the crows. Now, slightly different feeling about the crows, I have to say. Not only do they lurk in darker parts of the garden or swoop down from the sky when they see a small, plumptious little bird, they are the bullies. They are the bullies of the garden. They come in and they try and raid the nests. They'll swoop up a baby bird. They march across the grass like they own the place. So I have become an official scarecrow. I'll lunge out the house, goodness knows what time of the day or night, and flapping my arms and acting the goat, trying to scare them off. Scared my husband off, that's for sure. But I've now taught my dog, Sausage Dog Deluxe, to, when I shout, crow, he goes running out the back door and gallops on after them as well. Now, neither of us have got any chance of catching them, but I just want to scare them off because they have got nothing, as far as I can see, to offer me or my birdie residents. I'm open-minded. People tell me, gosh, they're intelligent. Well, if they're that intelligent, could they not work out how to flop up a little vegan salad for themselves and stop bullying the smaller ones? Yeah, corvid crows, carrion crows, they're not for me. And if I could get a way to get them out of my garden, I'd be first in the queue.
Alison Craig there, strangely anti-corvid. And we thought the best thing to do there was to bring Alison and writer Esther Wolfson together. Because Esther is a devotee of corvids. For many years, she had a rook, Mrs. Chickenbunkskaya, as a family pet, and she's written extensively and rather brilliantly about them. She was the very woman, we reckon, to change Alison's mind. Helen Needham was in hand to adjudicate.
I'm very, very much appreciate, Alison's pleasure in the garden and seeing the birds and so on. It's actually the language that you use, Alison, in describing these birds. You talk about lurking and looming and swooping, of there being bullies. And these are all anthropomorphic terms, the terms that we can use about other human beings. How can you tell that a bird is lurking? That is a human judgment. They're not doing anything nefarious or dangerous or nasty. They are doing, as everything else, trying to live. They're trying to find food. And I mean, I'm not mad about seeing fledglings being taken from their nest. But that is what happens in the natural world. If you don't like seeing it, don't look at it. And the idea of excluding one sort of bird is, why do it? Because you don't like the look of them. Why don't you like the look of them? Corvids are, yeah, they're intelligent, but that doesn't necessarily mean the suggestion that there's something sinister about them because they're clever. They're intelligent because they have had this very long evolution of social existence. They, you know, they're disputatious, they're noisy, because they live in big colonies, but it also has made them extremely intelligent. When you're, you know, you're chasing these birds, you're chasing away creatures with consciousness, with thought, very highly developed thought. The effect of chasing them away is that they are very, very good at defending small birds from predators. A crow will go and take on a sparrowhawk or a gull, which prevents the sparrowhawk from getting to the smaller birds. So it's an entirely misplaced thing to do.
In order to protect the bird so that it can...
Protect everybody. I mean, you know, corvids do not like hawks particularly, for good reason. Nobody, I mean, you know, the smaller birds don't. There are a lot of hawks about. I've seen crows engaging hawks, which means that, you know, the smaller birds are not then taken by the hawks. So, I mean, it's crazy to chase them away.
So, Esther, can we twist this slightly? But I wonder if you can sell the crow then.
Yes.
Extol the virtues.
They are amazingly able thinkers. As I said, they're creatures of consciousness. They feel love and grief and empathy. When I first got chick, I didn't realise. And it was her behaviour. It was her demonstration of intelligence that made me think, oh my God, we're not the only ones around here with brains. I was working in the book for years, and Chicken was, I mean, she was, in fact, I think she was probably had got to a record age for corvids, because she died in December at the age of 31. And she was with me really until the end, until I finished the book. So I wrote a dedication to her. And the dedication said, her name was Chicken. I said, to Chicken, Corvus frugiligus, which is the Linnaean name for a brook. Her dates were spring 1988 to the 9th of December 2019. And I said, colleague, companion, and friend. And that was what she was. I have learned everything I know about the world from crows. They've taught me my place in the world, which isn't that very high one. They've got these long cooperative social lives. They have very long memories. They have very passionate feelings. I mean, they hold grudges. I mean, in order to get any sort of sense of the way they live communally or anything, to see garden bird behaviour or, you know, behaviour in the birds that come to the garden, it is quite difficult because, you know, you have to study them over a long time in natural surroundings. Reading about them is probably the best thing, and then you perhaps start to see. I mean, but you just talk about, you know, them having BDI, and they've got that. I mean, I look at them close up. They're gorgeous things. They're beautiful things. Have a look at some of the gorgeous photographs taken. There's a woman in Canada who calls herself the crotographer, she's on Instagram. She takes beautiful pictures of corvids. And if you have a look at them, you might kind of begin to see the kind of, you know, the depth to these birds. And also reading about them, I mean, obviously I'm likely to recommend Corvus, but there are plenty of other books about corvids. You know, and then when you start seeing that they have this long history, this culture, this life, you start looking at them differently.
Mm. I mean, certainly, I think with crows, it's and it will be a perception that I've managed to glean from, you know, maybe my family, my friends, other people who, you know, discuss these sort of things. And
yeah,
they do need a good PR company, crows.
Well, they do. I mean, listen, I've tried. And I mean, I have to say, you know, there are, you know, book festivals and so on. People come up to me and go, oh, I'm so glad that somebody else likes crows. I mean, you're missing out on the joy of the corvid. I mean, they really are just fantastic. I mean, they've got huge senses of humour, and I mean, they really are. They're great. They're wonderful things.
Do we, you know, discussed doing this piece, I was walking yesterday and I saw, went past this beautiful garden. I was just looking in the garden and I saw this little, it was definitely a baby crew, and its little knock knees and everything, and it was walking about, and I thought, oh God, where's its mum? Is it going to be?
Oh, that awful moment, yeah.
So I, about 20 minutes later, I walked back along the same road, and it was still there and still in its own. And I thought, can I really come on and do this piece and go, actually, I've got a baby crew in the kitchen.
The advice now is to always to leave them. I mean, it's very difficult, you know.
Sad face, knobbly knee.
Yeah, they are very strange. You can actually see when, you know, when they're fledglings, you can actually see they are the last existing dinosaur or birds. And by God, you can see it from the babies.
Yes, it was very sweet. I'll have to walk past this afternoon and see if it's still there.
Oh, don't torture yourself.
Broadcaster Alison Craig and Esther Wolfson there. I think the phrase I would use there was telt. Alison's been telt in no uncertain terms.
It's a whole new genre of radio for us. Let's just set people up to have fights in the morning.
Well, there wasn't fights, just, you know, Esther's very, very passionate and very, very knowledgeable. I'm sorry to hear that chicken died, actually. I went round to Esther's house a few years ago to interview her, you know, and this elderly rook came up and kind of pecked away at my boot and sort of jumped up in the toe of my boot and what have you. It just a real character. You just, there was a wisdom to that bird. There really was.
No, she's right. You look into the eyes and they're giving you a great old look back. Yeah. Certainly, if you go close beside a raven, it's a really unnerving experience. You know, huge birds, and they're just looking at you and sizing you up.
Odin's bird, Odin's messenger. You know, it was supposed to be where he got all his information from. I've got a sheaf of answers here about this week's mystery birds, and let's just hear it again. Now, in fairness, you should get a prize if you've contacted the programme with the wrong answer, because it puts you very much in a minority. Heaps of folk are getting it right. But we will get to it fairly shortly. We like hearing where you listen. You can email us your stories at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, which is what Andrew Petrie from Brisbane, Australia did. He says, I listen to Out of Doors every week. It makes me smile. Your content and styles of delivery are grounded and positive and remind me to enjoy being alive and celebrate the world and the people around me. I was born in Scotland and my parents, Eddie and Elizabeth, still live in Blairgowrie. So hello to them if they're listening. I enjoyed your show a few weeks ago about trees and I want to share my favourite tree with you.
Yeah, it's called the Bunya pine. They're evergreen conifers. They grow up to about 45 metres high. There was one actually made 50 metres. What they like at them is they grow seed pods or cones, and these are big. They're really big. There's one tree near me that a neighbour's put a sign up warning drivers not to park under it when the pods are visible. And he sent a couple of photographs, one of a bunya, which is massive, and that sign, and the 10-kilogram cones. That's huge.
Here's something that it's timely. I can guarantee that by the time you get to the end of this, at least one stage, you will have scratched your face. It was about 9 o'clock on a beautiful, still summer's evening, and I was standing in the lower slopes of Halival on the island of Rum. It had rained that morning, but now the sun was setting in a clear sky. The light was golden, the air was as soft as milk, and there were cuckoos calling in the oak trees below me. It was, in short, absolutely hellish. That evening, the world was in soft focus as I looked at it through two things. The green mesh of my midgy hood and an unbelievably dense cloud of insects. I was hot. I was sweaty. I felt like I was being waterboarded. And the insect repellent I'd sprayed on the hood was making my eyes sting. My hands, which were gloveless, were black with the little brutes. In my humble opinion, Rum is the worst place in Scotland for midges. Now, I know that there are other areas in this fair land that would, for their own perverse reasons, lay claim to that title, but no, for me, Rum is the ultimate midgy hell. Now, Scotland proudly boasts about 35 species of midgy, but I'm going to concentrate on just one, Culicoides impunctatus, the Highland biting midge. They're not big. The wingspan's only about 2 to 3 millimetres, but there are an awful lot of them. Depending on the time of year and the weather conditions, there could be about 200 billion of them out there. The males are quite blameless. They spend their lives happily sipping nectar. It's only the female that bites you. She's born with enough fat to sustain her through her first batch of young, but thereafter she has to get a blood meal to feed subsequent broods. She's drawn to you by the carbon dioxide you exhale and then zeroes in on things like body odour, heat and colour. Given that I was pretty ripe after a day on the hill, puce with effort, and you could have frankly fried an egg in my face, none of this was good news. Once the first female midgie finds you, she's not selfish. There's lots of Aberdonian to go around, so she releases a pheromone which signals to all our pals, Senga, Morag, Big Cloda, that dinner is served, and out the hellish legion sallies. They fly up to you, find a patch of bare skin, use the serrated mouthparts to shave off a minute section, inject the wound with an anticoagulant to keep the blood flowing, and then they drink their fill. The bite is not the painful bit, and frankly, you won't miss the blood. It's the histamine reaction to the anticoagulant that will have you scratching and swearing for days afterwards. Being bitten by one midgie sounds bad enough, but Mountaineering Scotland, an organisation, in my experience, much given to stoical understatement, "What's the problem, Dougal? For goodness sake, man, you've got another leg," claims that up to 40,000 midges per hour can land in an unprotected arm, with sufferers enduring anything up to 11 bites per second. Now, nobody can endure that kind of punishment for long without ending up in the nearest bar.
The midges are no gone, it catches. The midges is really the limit.
So how can you protect yourself? Well, personally, I swear by midgie hoods. They're nae bonny, but they do work. You can actually get whole suits and gloves made of the same material. Yes, you end up looking like a cross between a bank robber and a belly dancer, but frankly, who gives a toss? You can try the chemical route. The British Army used to maintain a rigorous, if less than butch, moisturising regime with a product called Avon Skin So Soft. It's not really a midgie repellent, it's more of a super slippy coating, which means the little brutes can't get a foothold on you.
You can smack them and whack them, in vain you'll attack them, for they know every move that you make. If you manage to kill you, another half million are ready to come to the wake. Oh, the midges.
I used to favour stuff called Jungle Formula, until I realised that what I was happily slapping all over my youthful kisser was dissolving the black vinyl coating of my headphones. The active ingredient in Jungle Formula is N,N-diethyl metatoluamide, better known as DEET, and it is vicious. Bugs do hate it, but in humans, it's also been shown to lead to severe skin reactions, breathing difficulties, burning eyes. There have even been several reported cases of DEET-related seizures, and possibly, nobody's quite sure, and for obvious legal reasons, I'm inserting a huge question mark here, a few alleged DEET-related deaths. Oh, and it's thought to be carcinogenic too.
Now never forget when the sun's going to set and the midges arise on Loch Eck. Like the vampires you see played by Christopher Lee, they will give you a pin in the neck.
You can try the natural organic route, bog myrtle. It won't keep the midges off you, but maybe I've been using it wrong. I just stuffed some branches in my hat band, which was about as much use as whistling Dixie. But bog myrtle just happens to be one of the favourite food of beavers. So maybe I should have let myself be licked by a beaver. Maybe it's the beaver slavers that are good for midgie bites. Science is strangely silent on the subject. And finally, there's the current produit du jour, developed in bonny, midge-ridden Scotland to bamboozle the little swine. Research scientist Dr. Alison Blackwell set up a company called Advanced Pest Solutions after coming up with a product which contains something called Saltodon milk. And no, I was none the wiser either. Apparently it masks our smell so the midges can't find us. BBC guidelines prohibit me from giving you the name of the product, but suffice to say, it's a really simple anagram of midges. Now, it's easy to see these infuriating little creatures as the tiny handmaidens of Beelzebub, but surely even a midgie has some sort of saving grace, a single endearing characteristic. Well, yes, actually they do, and I love this about them. The blood-sucking Highland Midge is drawn to all humans, but for some reason, and this is absolutely true, seems to have a genuine preference for vegetarians. So that's my advice to you. When finally we are all allowed to go back out into the hills, take a vegetarian friend with you. They make fabulous decoys.
The midges is really the limit. With teeth like piranhas, they drive you bananas if you let them get under your cement.
Kenneth McKellar there and his midges.
This program's rapidly becoming just a voice for your this collection.
Strange though it is. Midges, yeah. I mean, I was saying that rum. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, rum is the possible worst point. Second place, I would say, was Arisig. Alexander reckons it's Tyne Bruach.
I'm with you on the rum one, because when you were doing it, I vividly remember going to rum and just fleeing onto a boat and never going back.
Yeah.
It's pretty bad. Although Mull's pretty bad as well.
Where were we again? Was it Tarbert when we were doing the Bell Lorry? Remember years ago, and incredibly, despite the fact we've been outdoor broadcasting for a long, long time, nobody had any midge repellent. We were trying to do it live from the front, the pier, we were so desperate, we actually put a shout out and said, if anybody's listening to this with a midge repellent, please come and help.
And somebody came along with it as well.
A hatch threw open on a yacht. This guy went, as he ran towards us, he shouted, close your eyes! You know, it went past him. What a relief. What a relief.
I remember that vividly as well. Suddenly seeing myself in the mirror, covered in little bits of black plastic, and like you, it melted my headphones.
Yes,
it was
absolutely.
Scary stuff.
Yeah, no, it's not great. Not great. Anyway, we've got heaps of comments coming in on all sorts of things. But earlier this week, you might have seen the news that the village of Comrie and the surrounding area of Perthshire had a wee bit of an earthquake. Now, Comrie is actually the earthquake capital of the UK, so much so that it's home to a building called the Earthquake House. To tell us more about it, I've joined one of the house's custodians, Chris Palmer. Good morning, Chris. How are you doing?
Good morning, Mark. Yeah, I'm fine. Thanks.
I've actually spoken to you at the Earthquake House, but for those who haven't been there, explain it for me. You know, describe it.
It's a small built much smaller than people think when they hear about the Earthquake House. You know, people think that it might be a visitor centre type building, but it's measures about 2.5 metres square, a small stone building with a pyramidal slate roof. And I think it is now acknowledged to be the smallest listed building in Britain for its scientific interest. There was a period from about 1780 through to 1880, when there was a huge number of earth tremors in and around Comrie. Over 7,000 earth tremors were measured over that period. There were people in the village, initially two church ministers, and then a shoemaker and the postmaster, who became interested in trying to measure them. And they tried various different instruments and invented instruments of their own, and then got help later on from other scientists. They tried these instruments in various buildings around the village, the White Church steeple and the post office and various other buildings. And then later on in 1869, they had the Earthquake House built, and it sits on a little outcrop of rock in the middle of this field in the Ross in Comrie.
The thing that just drives me nuts is it's because it's lazy usage. You know, you hear people saying, you know, this was the absolute epicenter, in which they take to mean, you know, the very, very center of something. And that's not what it means at all. Explain what epicenter means.
I'm not a seismologist, so...
You'll do till one comes along, Chris. Come on.
Yeah, the discovery of the position of the epicenter was established early on by the Comrie pioneers, as they became known, these four guys. You can sort of triangulate from various places now where the centre of the location is. And the epicentre for the event that we had last Saturday was up in Glenlednoch, at the lower end of Glenlednoch, at the foot of a hill called Crappick Hill, just behind the Melville Monument in Comrie.
The epicentre essentially is the point on the surface of the earth immediately above where the earthquake incident happened. You know, and because you've got this detecting equipment, you can actually work, you can triangulate it, you can work out where it was. How big an event was it?
Well, it was 2.2 on the scale, the magnitude. So it was a hefty shake. I mean, lots of people in the village felt it. I was sitting reading the paper in the house, and there was a loud bang as well as the shake, almost like a quarry blast. And lots of people have described it in different ways. Somebody said it was like a huge snowdrift had collapsed from the roof, and someone said it was like a thunderclap. And here where we live in the Ross, lots of our neighbours came out into the street and went up to have a look at to see whether it had recorded. So most people twigged that it was an earth tremor, yeah.
Why Cromery?
We're just north of the Highland Boundary Fault, which runs from Arran, Dumbarton, across Loch Lomond, up to Stonehaven. So we're just off that fault line. And it's thought to be possibly another minor fault line that comes off that towards Cromery. The last event that I felt was in 2012, so prior to this one. So we get them from time to time.
It's a fascinating wee place, Chris, and thank you very much for joining us again this morning.
Okay, good. Right, well, thanks,
No problem at all. Once you can actually travel to Cromery, if it's a possibility, once you can actually travel to, you can get, normally you can't get inside the building itself, but you can peer through the window, you know, and see the seismometer on the inside. So that's worth a shift in and of itself, Ewan.
I've never been. I was quite fascinated when you're more into epicentres than I am. But I've never actually been in an earthquake. It must be quite a scary thing.
No recall of having experienced one either. Right, the hugely popular mystery bird. Have we hit that point yet?
Yeah, here we go. No bird throughout history has had a more checkered character than the magpie. Known quite simply as the pie until the 17th century, when mag, or chattering, got added to the name. And it really does have a distinctive chatter like no other. A chatter that folk either love or hate. So why does the magpie arouse such passion? Well, mainly because they're bright. Really bright. And if you're lucky enough to get up close to a raven, a rook or a magpie and look them in the eye, it's unnerving. There's some serious intelligence looking back at you. Humans, dolphins and magpies are just a few of the world's animals that can recognise themselves in a mirror. And like no other bird, they live in a world frighteningly close to ours. Here is a magpie grieving beside a dead magpie which was killed on the road. A group of five magpies of a parliament gather by the body and mourn. And that empathy has led to many rituals. Rituals that folk still carry out to this day. Saluting magpies is an old English tradition and is said to ward off bad luck. Coming across a lone magpie, the correct procedure is to say, "Hello, Mr. Magpie. How's Mrs. Magpie? And all the little magpies." And the really superstitious can double down on this by spitting three times over their shoulder and flapping their arms like wings. And there's more. You should repeat the words, "I defy thee," seven times, or pinch the person alongside you. And the custom in Devon is to spit three times to avert ill luck. Others salute a lone magpie in order to show it respect. But this formality can be ignored if the magpie looks directly into your eyes, which shows it respects you. And an old English folktale states that when Jesus was crucified on the cross, all of the world's birds wept and sang to comfort him in his agony. The only exception was the magpie, and for this it was forever cursed. The well-known magpie rhyme goes, "One for sorrow, two for joy, three for a girl, four for a boy, five for silver, six for gold, seven for a secret never to be told, eight for a wish, nine for a kiss, ten for a bird you must not miss." So what does that actually mean? Well, nobody's really sure. It's said if the birds turn up at a wedding, then they could predict the sex of the future children, but the rest? And the lyrics have also changed. In the 18th century, it went along the lines of one for sorrow, two for mirth, three for a wedding, and four for a death. Magpies also split nations. In Britain, the birds are associated with witchcraft, and in Yorkshire, people used to cross themselves when they saw one. We Scots used to believe that the magpies had a drop of the devil's blood under their tongue, and if one was seen near a window, death could not be far behind. The French had a more positive view of magpies and honoured them by tying bundles of shrubs, such as laurel and heath, high up in a tree. And this is the remembrance of when the chattering magpies alerted people to the presence of a wolf. In China, the magpies are thought to bring good fortune, and Mongolians believe the birds control the weather. But what about magpies stealing shiny things? Well, the University of Exeter managed to get funding. They tempted the birds with piles of food. Beside these, they placed shiny objects such as rings, pieces of foil and screws. And only twice out of 64 tests did the birds go for a shiny bauble, and even then they quickly discarded it. The man who carried out the study, Stephen Lee, told the BBC, "We can't say that magpies never steal shiny objects, but we have no reliable evidence that the magpies, more than any other bird, are attracted to shiny objects more than any other object." Of course, there's another theory. Magpies, as we know, are highly intelligent. And who's to say they didn't figure out what the boffins in the lab coats were up to and messed about with their heads? They're clever things, magpies.
It's a great sound. I remember, you know, when we got married for a start, we went down to Glasgow and I couldn't believe the number of magpies because they really weren't common at all in Aberdeenshire at the time.
I've got none here at all. I've got some about half a mile away.
Yeah.
And just the church. They've always been there, but no, very rarely come up here at all.
Tons of correct answers this morning. Colin and Mary Abercrombie, who are swats, says we're paddling down the River Forth this morning, starting from Stirling at high tide. Gary in Bennycook says magpie, the terror of starling and blackbird fledglings. Agnes from Errol says morning, I think the sound is the chatter of a magpie. Maeve in Inverurie, is it a magpie? Yes, it is. And goes on to say your lovely programme takes the sting out of this rainy morning. Thanks. Trish says it's a magpie, a two nesting in the garden until a storm destroyed the nest. They made this noise every time the dog went out. That'll be that French thing with the wolves. Ian Willie says, think it might be the magpie, brilliant programme. And this is, the Mr. Bird sounds very much like a magpie. When I hear this alarm call, I look to see the cause. Often it's a cat or some other threat. That's from the Scarlet Sheep, Stockholm in Sweden.
Uncannily, a magpie has just arrived on the tree beside me.
Well, there you go.
I haven't seen one here for 20 years. That's scary.
See, they are very, very smart birds, as you rightly pointed out.
Yeah.
You can hear the firewood sparking away in the, you know, the car park here at BBC Aberdeen at Beechgrove of a Saturday morning. I accept the fact its quality is variable. But you had recently been trying to remember the best firewood you can get.
I'm sitting in my study and it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon and summer's gone. The rain is lashing down outside. The temperature's plummeted and I've got a log fire on. And I just chucked some well-seasoned beech in and there was a bit of Scots pine and I was trying to remember about a poem that somebody sent in or put us in touch with about which is the best wood to buy, and I've dug it out. It's a firewood poem published in the Times, March the 2nd, 1930. These hardwoods burn well and slowly, ash, beech, hawthorn, oak and holly. Softwoods flare up quick and fine, birch, fir, hazel, larch and pine. Elm and willow, you'll regret, chestnut green and sycamore wet. Beechwood fires are bright and clear, if the logs are kept a year. Chestnuts only good, they say, if for long to is laid away. But ash new, or ash old, is fit for a queen with crown of gold.
It's about the only tree I can think of that you could take a branch straight from the tree and burn it.
Yeah, I was sceptical, I must admit, when I read that poem, so I tried it. And yeah, it burns, it's just incredible.
Yeah. Going back to the midges we were talking about earlier, Alan Pennycook says a wee dab of Cubby's midge save behind the ear has worked for me, in addition to the midge hood and jacket, of course. Ananias says in 1988 I was in the Cook Islands, I'm not sure where those are, and mozzies were the size of light aircraft. We ate large quantities of raw garlic, worked like magic. Lil in Forest says, last year we bought these little electronic zappers for midgie bites. Not sure how effective they are, but they're a great excuse to electrocute your children repeatedly. Good.
Don't do it.
Just stop it. And Alistair in 10 says, Sandy Simpson from Alistair in 10 says, good morning on the Crow subject. During a night shift on the Brent Bravo, a young loon fringe tells us a poem. Craw, 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 said an old Dane craw, as he decked his neb on a docking. I'm wearing a wah, but I care near straw, for I've tasted the tatties a buchan. That's the kind of thing, he says, that helped the knights go in. And that is it. Now, obviously, we know that this podcast is listened to around the world. We want to try and get to as many people as we possibly can, because people seem to be enjoying it. Just in terms of sharing it, if you've got the time to like this, or indeed tell a friend about it, point them in the right direction, we'd be much obliged. From all of the team here in BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.